Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. When North Korea reportedly tested an atomic weapon late last week, it was literally an earth-shaking event. Seismologists in the United States were able to detect the man-made earthquake from the blast.
It was also metaphorically earth-shaking news, especially for people in other Pacific Rim nations, such as Japan and South Korea. It's where we start our look at international news with contributor Art Sear. Hi, Art.
It's a pleasure to be here, always.
What do you make of North Korea's current behavior as far as nuclear weapons goes?
It's more of the same. It is more in literal terms. The last warhead they detonated is apparently considerably larger than they have in the past. They're also slowly, fitfully, but surely developing a more competent and reliable missile capability for long-range delivery, not to the United States, as far as we know, but certainly to Japan as well as South Korea. It is worrisome.
Worrisome for the United States, but probably even more worrisome to its immediate neighbors, South Korea, for example, Japan, and others.
And China. They are ideologically allies, and ideology means a lot, something we tend to overlook since the end of the Cold War. Pyongyang and Beijing, North Korea, and China are significant allies, and our best hope, I think, is that China, which has been reluctant to turn the screws on North Korea, they have greater economic leverage than any other nation, will be harsher and firmer in trying to rein in North Korea. They don't want a general war. No one does. I don't think even the North Koreans do.
Well, what do you think the North Koreans want?
They want respect. They want aid. Probably respect above all. But also the economy has been a basket case for many years. They've had periodic famine. Earlier this year, for the first time in many years, there was a party congress in North Korea. Kim Jong-un, symbolism is important, especially in dealing with communist powers. The great leader wore a business suit rather than his usual overdone military uniform. And he was pretty blunt for him in referring to the economic problems of the country.
Well, so the obvious question might be, why doesn't North Korea ask for aid in a different way?
They are a very erratic regime. We had a comprehensive agreement way back in the mid-1990s. For them to receive a tremendous amount of aid, especially oil fuel, in return for ending their nuclear weapons program. It is important to keep in mind that that agreement was ended not by them, but by us, the U.S. House of Representatives, with a new Republican majority under then-Speaker Newt Gingrich, abrogated the agreement. I'm not saying things would be better now if that hadn't happened, but given the paranoid nature of the regime, it's important to keep in mind that we have not always been consistent in dealing with them. I think they truly are paranoid. The ruling elite has a very comfortable as well as powerful existence, and I'm confident they're afraid that if they're too flexible, that could well detonate the end of the regime in political as well as economic terms.
Well, and technically speaking, we do not have diplomatic ties with North Korea. So who are we using to work behind the scenes, if you will?
That's a very good question. I think Beijing is our most important ally. I believe we should be encouraging South Korea as much as possible to deal directly with the North. There is in place a six-power framework, which includes both Koreas, Japan, China, the U.S., and Russia, which has reached some limited agreements in the past. And I think we should give highest priority to South Korea, the Seoul regime, and current President Park Geun-hye, who's a very, very able leader in my opinion. She should be taking the lead on the peninsula, but we do have a framework in place as well.
Now, another aspect to this story that I've read about and I'm curious to get your take on is the idea that one other benefit for North Korea to its latest actions is in the area of potentially being a supplier of weapons, modifying Scud missiles, for example.
They are very, very active in the black market worldwide. And the short answer is yes. I'm sure they'd be interested in generating income from whatever source.
Like these are, I mean, almost the equivalent of a commercial for them.
In a way, except if they were caught supplying nuclear weapons as opposed to conventional weapons. Again, you name the kind of conventional weapon, Also drugs, bootleg liquor, counterfeit currency, prostitution. You name the ugly trade, and North Korea seems to be heavily in it, and they need that income. So logically, it's understandable that they would take the next step into nuclear fuel that could be processed or even nuclear weapons. However, it would be actually quite difficult, I think, to keep that secret. The Israelis, with close U.S. cooperation, I believe, in 2010, destroyed a nuclear development facility in Syria. North Korea was working hand in glove with the Syrians at that point. There's been no restarting of that activity. I believe our intelligence, based on what's happened as well as what's known in open sources, our intelligence community internationally would pick up on that very quickly. I don't think it's going to happen. So the short answer in terms of reality is no.
Okay, so you mentioned Syria, and this is as good a time to pivot to Syria as any. And over the weekend, a ceasefire was announced, a framework for a ceasefire in any case. This is not the first time there has been some evidence of a breakthrough to try to bring down the hostilities in Syria. And as has been the case in the past, it hasn't seemed to have had a major impact.
Well, let's wait and see what happens. War weariness is a very real factor. The losses on both sides, all sides, have been pretty terrific. The civilian population in Syria has suffered tremendously. I think there is an incentive to try to end the killing. You're right. There was a ceasefire agreement earlier this year in February, which by May seemed to have come unraveled. Russia and the U.S. have a very powerful interest in working together. And whenever these two great powers can work together, I think that's a plus. There was a lot of criticism of Russia and Putin, understandably, approximately a year ago when Russia intervened directly by force. But I think on balance, that's been a stabilizing factor.
So would you say the war weariness is the chief difference between the ceasefire agreement in February and the ceasefire agreement in September?
I hope so. Also, there's no clear distinction between moderate and extremist rebel forces in Syria, except perhaps in the minds of some of those in the current White House administration. There's going to be fighting and there's going to be killing, even if the ceasefire holds. However, on balance, I think insofar as it permits everyone else to focus in on limiting and killing the Islamic State, I think chances are pretty good that it's going to work. I also have great respect for Secretary of State John Kerry, an almost unbelievably hardworking senior leader and a man with considerable diplomatic skill who has gotten tangible results in the Obama administration in his current job.
Well, so are the U.S. and Russia really the only two countries that can hold the various parties in Syria, their feet to the fire, to make this stick? Or are there cards that any of Syria's neighbors can yet play?
Well, it's complicated and maddening, and there are always many players involved in the Middle East. But Russia and the U.S. have the principal, I think, not only economic as well as military power leverage, but the principal stakes. It's important to keep in mind that during the height of the Cold War and thereafter, the Soviet Union and the successor Russia have had powerful influence throughout the region. For a long time, the very stark conflict between Israel and just about everyone else, the Arab states in the region, underscored that confrontation between us and them. The fact that we're able to work together now in this historical context, I think, is encouraging.
Let me throw one more question at you from another part of the world, a somewhat different part of the world. I'm surprising you here, but we haven't heard much out of the UK as far as implementing Brexit goes in really a couple of months, almost since the ballot took place. What do you know about the state of things in Great Britain?
I think no news is good news. The vote in no case would have meant immediate departure from the European Union as a common market. A negotiation of approximately 2 years is required. The new British government has been very clear and explicit in stating they will abide by the will of the people and negotiate a withdrawal. The pound sterling, the British never joined the common currency, the euro. The pound sterling has gone down, but it certainly hasn't nosedived. Other economic indicators actually are rather encouraging. I do believe the strength of the global economy, the strength of the British economy, now the number five economy in the world, and the relatively pivotal open trading position of Britain means that the country probably will not suffer greatly as a result of leaving Brexit. I'm also the fellow who predicted that they probably would not vote to leave, however, so please take this appropriately.
That's why we did not invite you on here to help people choose their fantasy football teams.
Thank you very much.
Art Sear, thanks.
Thank you.
Art Sear is professor of political economy and world business. He's also the director of the A.W. Clausen Center for World Business at Carthage College in Kenosha. He's also a regular Lake Effect contributor.